Here's that $3 I told you I'd give you for bringing it up.
You've been participating in MOGAs since then.
Yes, competed in all of them.
Planning on participating in the 2007.
I already have my reservations made. I'm looking forward to it. I'm not going to do the team thing this year. I had been doing a two-man team with DigiGuy, and he's on staff this year, so I'm just going to run the individual course again, I think.
For your work, you have to do a lot of training. Do you have to pass physicals every year? Is there a regular program where, like, you got to work out 3 times a week?
We're the only unit in the department that's allowed to work out on duty. We get 2 days a week when we can spend an hour in a gym. That helps, and then, of course, 2 hours a week isn't enough. You do some on your own time, too. But we do get to work out, and then 4 times a year we have to pass a fitness test, which is kind of tough for an old guy like me anyway. Everybody else on the team is 15 and 20 years younger than me, and I'm trying to keep up with them, so it gets harder every year.
Are you in a supervisory role? Or?
No, the hostage team's made up of a lieutenant who's the unit commander. There are 4 sergeants, 1 is an administrative sergeant, and 3 have squads. And the 3 who have squads each have about 8 guys under them. And I'm one of those under them guys. I'm bottom rung on the ladder. When the call first comes out, the supervisors respond and assess the situation, and then they call out whatever manpower and equipment they feel is necessary to handle it. So sometime, in a rare circumstance, they might only call out 1 squad of 8 guys. Typically, it's at least 2 and sometimes all 3.
In a normal week, very similar to like firefighters where there's long stretches of boredom with very quick spikes of adrenaline rushes. And then, I mean, you can't consistently say, well, there's going to be 1 or 2 emergencies a week.
My unit does a lot of different things. We're kind of a reserve unit. We're not assigned to the district. We don't patrol like the normal guys patrol. And what that does is it frees us up to be available to respond to whatever emergency comes along without being a drain on the manpower in the districts. When we're doing our specialty things, we do that, and when we're not doing the specialty items like the hostage rescue and the weapons of mass destruction, then they send us into the high crime areas. Now, myself, I do a lot of the administrative stuff at the office, too, so I don't patrol as much. I'm mostly on the desk unless I get called out to do one of the other things that we do.
They had some practice type of major disaster, and they had volunteers come in. What was that about?
They simulated a dirty bomb going off at the stadium. It was just a practice drill. We do those at least once or twice a year. That was for the weapons of mass destruction team. We respond and we put on the moon suits and the air tanks and the, you know, and all of that, and we go in, and it's a kind of a combination of the hostage rescue training and the weapons of mass destruction training, because we go in and we would, for example, if there were terrorists set this bomb off and there were still some terrorists in there, we would have to go in and make the scene safe before the emergency rescue people could go in and start treating the people who were in there. And you practice with the decon and all the different things, so it gets pretty involved. The more prepared you are, the less likely it is to happen. I hope, anyway.
Jumping quickly back over to geocaching, I remember that there was one time when you were trying to get some type of consensus with all the city parks in general.
It was St. Louis City. I went to the Parks and Recreation Department, just kind of broke the ice, asked them if they knew what geocaching was to start with, and they didn't. So I sat down and explained to them, and I set up, I had a liaison with the city who not on a regular basis, but every couple of months I'd send him a list of what caches were located in the city parks. And we just kind of tried to keep in touch in case they had a problem or we had a problem, we'd have somebody to talk to. I think it was just this last year now for Earth Day, somebody from SLAGA called me and said, hey, can you call the city parks and see if they have some place where we can do an Earth Day project for a Macedo event. When I emailed this guy, he's retired and there's no other contact. Every time I try and work something with them, they're not putting a whole lot of effort into their side of it, it seems like, and it just keeps falling apart. I guess sometime I'm going to have to try to make contact with them again, with the big boss, and see if he can set me up with a new liaison, and we'll try and get it going again.
How does that affect caches that are currently in the city? No official approval process?
There is no official approval process. They've pretty much said, go ahead, you have permission. But I bet there's close to 30 caches at least that are either in city parks or in Tower Grove Park, which technically is privately held. Everybody thinks it's a city park, but it's not. There are some areas within the city parks, like Forest Park especially. The zoo is a separate entity. It's all, you know, the ground is owned by the park, but it's it's like it's being like a concessionaire type of thing where the zoo is running the zoo, even though it's in the park. So you would technically, I guess, need permission from the zoo to place one there. I haven't tackled that problem.
I'm not going to fix something that isn't broken. It seems to be working smoothly.
And Kathy and I like to travel. We've got a cruise coming up here pretty soon, in fact. We get out to Colorado once in a while, and I always try to do some research, find out where there are going to be caches along the way. We've found caches in Panama, Mexico, England, Scotland. We get around a little bit, plus about 11 or 12 of the United States, a couple in Canada. I never set aside a week and say, okay, we're going on a caching trip, but I always try to fit in caching with whatever trip we do go on.
Yeah, that's a delicate balance. Mm-hmm. Like, honey, we're not going to spend all of our time just looking for caches.
If it was me, I'd set aside a couple of days sometime and just set out a route where you just spend all day, every day caching and come home with a whole bunch of experiences and cash numbers and, you know.
Wayne, I'm going to take a week and I'm going to go to Arkansas.
Yeah, that's not going to float in this house.
If you find things in geocaches that are contraband, are you taking those out and reporting those back to the cache owner? Or you say, it's none of my business?
Geocaching contraband and what I consider contraband might be two different things. You know, I'm talking crack cocaine, marijuana.
Food,
that's contraband.
Food is a geocaching contraband, yeah. But yeah, you're right.
I haven't really found too much of it, to be honest with you. There was an item one time, or kind of an adult item in one, that I just took out and pocketed it, and I don't think I ever contacted the owner. I just got rid of it.
What about places where people place caches where you know they didn't get permission? Or it's an unsafe area?
I don't think I've run into that. I've been out a few times where, you know, you're on your way to the cache and you're 300 feet away and you run into a fence and it says no trespassing. Well, I turn around and leave. If I travel 8 miles to get there and I get within 200 feet and it says no trespassing, I leave because, you know, that's just the way I am. You always kind of wonder, well, is there another way to get there where you can do it without trespassing? Unless you take the time to explore and know that it's impossible to get there, I just leave it go at that. It's off limits and that's that. The people that I have been geocaching with, I only know for sure of one person who has a concealed carry license. I never bothered to ask him. I don't know, it's his business, and if he's licensed and he's legally able to, that's up to him. If people ask me if I'm carrying a gun, you know, depending on how well I know them, I'll either answer them or I won't, because it's really probably none of their business either. You know, I've put a few people in jail, and I've had one or two experiences where I've been off duty at a wedding reception and sat down across a table from somebody that I'd locked up before, and I was kind of glad I had it with me, you know. But it's none of his business that I have it with me, and that's my ace in the hole.
How often do you find that you have to remember when you're on duty and when you're not on duty? Is it easier for you to leave your work at work and come home and separate that?
Yeah, pretty much so. I learned that a long time ago. That, you know, I'll come home and grumble for about 5 minutes to Kathy about what a miserable day I've had, and then that's the end of it. I let it go. Bringing it out and making it a part of your family's life is, you can control that. You just shut up and let it go. But what's in your head is in your head. And you see and hear things at work sometimes. There are things that I've seen 20 years ago on this job that once in a while I still lay awake and think about it. Some things just don't go away.
In your type of career, is it hard to be optimistic about humanity, about people? I mean, how much do you have to balance out? You're spending all your time with these emergencies and bad things. How do you balance out the other side to say, oh, there are good things that are happening?
I mean, we work with the scum. Mostly that's who they send us to deal with, and that's what your 8 hours at work is all about. But it's just the opposite when I come home. I've got a very good family life, and I'm very happy, and I just try to turn everything else off. I know that I've got it pretty darn good in spite of some of the things I have to go put up with.
So maybe that's it. Maybe what you see during a normal work day makes you appreciate more what
you have. Oh, yeah. And even when I'm at work, I'll see something and I'll think, I'm so glad I can go home in 4 hours and just leave this behind. So, I mean, I was a scout as a kid, and I loved it. I got away from it for a few years. Once my son got old enough to join, I was right back in it, and now he's graduated out of it, and he's been gone from scouts for 3 years, but I'm still active in it. I just like getting out. I like doing the outdoorsy stuff. The troop that I'm with, we got a pretty good bunch of kids, and the adult leaders I get along with well, they're friends. We've been on some a lot of trips together and had some good times, and it's almost as much for me as it is for the kid.
Did you ever go through a burnout period?
No, my schedule is such that I go for periods without having an opportunity to do any caching. When I do get a little free time, other things have backed up too. I've got to take care of the house. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. You know, little projects and honeydews. And I've never gotten to the point where I was really burned out. When the opportunity is there, I'm usually up for it.
So geocaching is this fruit that just keeps ripening as time goes on.
Kind of. When you're doing it, you have to kind of concentrate on it. You have to pay attention. Really concentrate on the details to be able to find some of these well-hidden caches. When you concentrate on one thing, it blocks everything else out and gives you kind of a vacation from it. Other hobbies. I have too many hobbies, actually. I mean, we ski and we fish and I camp and I hike and I backpack and I hunt and I bike ride, and I never do enough of one thing to get good at it, but I enjoy doing a little. I like the variety of getting out and just trying a lot of different things.
Oh, it was interesting when I looked at the map. Okay, there's Grant's Trail.
That was a neat idea. I really like that. Kathy and I both went on a Saturday or Sunday, maybe a Sunday morning, and I did half of the trail. I never did get back out and finish up the rest of it, but I'm looking forward to that because there's a little spur that comes off of that trail that runs right past my mother's nursing home. It runs right to her parking lot. So when the weather's nice, we put Mom in a wheelchair and we walk and we do Grant's Trail, and she loves getting out of the home. It's so nice to get a change of scene, you know. And I've been talking about geocaching to her for years, so when the weather gets nice again, we're going to take her out and actually do some geocaching with her. And I'm sure there's half a dozen of them within our walking distance. We'll take Mom geocaching. I'm sure she'll enjoy that.
You can get at least 60 at MOGA 2007.
60 at MOGA. I'm planning on getting all 60. Hidden in plain view. Those are my favorites. Hidden in plain view. I like those because they're just sneaky.
Very rarely do I go back three times to a cache. The bird poop?
The bird thing one. That's the one that the final was in an object. He had used that object once before and took it away. He disabled that cache and then used that same object again. So I went and I looked for that waypoint, and I looked and I looked and I looked and I couldn't find it, and I gave up, and I was walking back to the car and I spotted the object and I recognized it from the first time, and then so I was able to get the cache without finding that intermediate waypoint.
There was a new geocacher and his buddy. I found out that they just started, so I met them out at one of the parks near Booter. They had looked for that when they couldn't find it. So I said, well, I'll come with you. I guided them with, you know, hot, cold. Finally, when the guy realized what it was, for at least 5 minutes, he was laughing. He was on the ground. He's like, ah! It was a sight to be seen. And then they found the final pretty easily as we're walking back, you know, which is sitting there on the side. And like, I've not usually had trouble with DigiEye caches, except for a few.
All wound up caches, the first ones.
I didn't find 1 and 2 on that. I haven't gone back.
I haven't done number 3 yet. I've got 1 and 2.
I've done 3. 3, I don't think, is exactly like 1 and 2. Obviously, the tape is the same, but how 3 is hidden couldn't be like the others. Wound up 1, I think, is the one where Dan keeps telling me, oh, yeah, it just keeps moving around. People look down and they kick it. And then it moves. So, like, okay, it's got to be in a piece of wood or something on the ground. With that hand, I still haven't gone back yet.
It's tough.
And then the one down by the creek in the tree, that's wound up too, I think.
I know I spent at least 2 hours searching for that on 2 different occasions and finally found it on the 3rd time I was down there with some help. But usually I don't, but that one just aggravated me. I mean, I knew what I was kind of what I was looking for, just couldn't find it. I was just out this morning scouting, looking for a spot to put a new cache. So I'm continuing my little Boy Scout series of caches. I've got the Tenderfoot, Second Class, First Class, and Star are all in place, and this one, I guess, will be Life. That's next, and then I'll have to start working on Eagle. This one, I think it's going to be kind of neat, too. It's either going to be really hard to find, and people are going to be, like, kicking themselves when they finally find it. I have never seen one hidden quite like this before. I've kind of invented it. It's just a little twist on the theme, you know. And it'll be a little puzzle to get the coordinates and then go find it. In my first class cache, I've got a bonus cache that you can actually log it twice if you find the bonus. They know there is a bonus, but they have to find the coordinates. Very few people have logged the bonus. It's a tricky one. There was one that kind of upset me a little bit from an ecological point of view, and I can't remember the name of it. It was in Rocket Park. and it was well hidden, and there was a lot of ivy ground cover. I went out once and looked for it and couldn't find it, and went back a week or so later to look for it, and the ground cover had just been torn to pieces. And I thought, yeah, that's kind of a shame. That's not the kind of legacy we want as geocachers.
Were you around for the Blue Monkey Bad Karma?
Mm-hmm. I had done both of those before, and I had no problem with them. I mean, if it seems to me that the rule about not digging should apply to the searchers. You shouldn't be digging and tearing things up. If somebody has permission to very neatly dig a hole and put it back and fix the pet cache permanently in there and not do any ecological damage, I don't see a problem with that. The problem comes in when you have people going out looking for a cache and they can't find it, so they start digging things up. If they know that they don't have to dig to find the cache, then that should solve that problem.
There's a fine line between challenging and frustrating.
Yes, I've heard you say that before, and I agree.
And I have been guilty of turning over too many rotted trees, thinking, oh, well, it's got to be in here. Oh, no, that's not it. It's already rotten, and I've broken it off. I'm not going to neatly put it back the way it was.
The guy that took those caches out when he wasn't supposed to, by his own admission, he was trespassing and all kinds of stuff that day to get to this cache. And then he said he cleared an area of ground cover like 30 feet in diameter. Well, that's more damage right there than has been done by cachers in all the years that cache was in place. And then he's going to say that somebody else was wrong for putting it there. He's the one that's causing a problem, you know. Federal land and things like that. I think that's why there should still be virtual caches. I know a lot of people are down on those, and they want to have something that you can sign the log, but I think there's a time and a place for a virtual. Kathy and I are going on a cruise, I think I mentioned before, and when you try to look for caches that are close to a wharf area or a pier, something that you can do when you're on a cruise, you know, pick up a cache in Uruguay and a different thing, you don't have that many opportunities in life to get to some of those places, you know, and it'd be nice to be able to do that. They just aren't there, and you can't put them there because you can't maintain them. It would be nice if they could make, like, a virtual cache as kind of a second class. Even if it's a fine, but if somebody comes in and wants to place an actual cache there, you have to yield to them. You know, so you're not gonna block areas and keep caches out of them by doing that, but you've still got something for people to find in places where there's no reason that there can't be a cache other than the guy that owns the land says no.
Waymarking the replacement of virtuals. Now, locationless I really didn't care much for, and that was kind of
some of those
arbitrary.
Were fun. I've done a few of those because they were kind of fun.
Well, every time I saw a yellow Jeep, I'm like...
a yellow Jeep? No, I didn't log that one.
No, I like the virtuals that were kind of rare. You can't make every McDonald's a virtual. That
no,
ridiculous.
That's silly. Now, I've got a virtual that I own in Bermuda that I did while we were on vacation down there. And it's a lighthouse with a lot of history to it. It's a cast iron lighthouse, which is, you know, there were not that many of them made. It was actually made in England and shipped to Bermuda and reassembled with using slave labor, built on the highest spot on the island, so the views are fantastic. You can climb up in it and look around, and tea room and a gift shop, but the views are great from up there. When you've been there, you've been someplace worth being. Forget your GPS if you have to, but take your camera, because, man, it's really neat up there. I'll let that one live as long as it will. If someone, like I said, if somebody comes along and emails me and says, I want to put a real cache up here, well, that's fine with me. I'll get rid of mine.
Probably isn't that big of a chance that someone's going to put one there. And
on an island the size of Bermuda, there probably aren't that many people who are residents who do geocaching. So who's going to take care of that?
Okay. Well, we'll call that a podcast.
This concludes the Slogga Podcast. For more information about the Slogga Group and geocaching in the St. Louis, Missouri area, go to www.geostl.com. Here's wishing you a strong signal and a trusty bearing.